Imagine you are not seeing this mosaic, and I have to give you information so that you understand what it shows and you are able to repair it if need be. The only way I can achieve it is if I tell you what pebble, what size, what color, which position. So I have to give you information on several hierarchical levels. Exactly the same is the case with bone. To understand its properties, everything is important, from the amino acids to the collagen to the whole bone organ. Bone is a hierarchically structured material combining three components: mineral, organic matrix, and water. And its mechanical properties are dependent on all three components, their quantity and quality. Their quantity and quality is not constant throughout the organ, but it is greatly dependent on tissue age and health status. When it comes to mechanical properties, we have three attributes: modulus, which is the average of a property over the whole organ. Therefore, the question that should be asked is how much and of what quality. Then we have strength and toughness, which are dependent on micro imperfections and also interfaces. So the correct question is how much, what quality, and where. And actually, we have several review articles that tells us that it is strength and toughness that are responsible for fragility fracture and not modulus. It is well accepted nowadays that bone strength depends on the amount, the structural properties of bone, and the material properties. All three are modulated by bone turnover. Material properties can be modulated by independent factors. And this is my personal bias: material properties to a certain extent dictate structural properties. Bone homeostasis can be given empirically by this equation, where we have the number of forming sites times the osteoblast production times the subsequent rate of accrual minus the number of resorbing sites times what I call osteoclast appetite. Osteoclast appetite, how much bone is resorbed by each osteoclast, next to impossible to determine because usually we have multinucleated giant cells. Number of forming sites and number of resorbing sites is what we routinely report as bone turnover. Osteoblast production is what and how much each osteoblast is doing. Nowadays, it is very easy to say we have this many osteoblasts present, but it is much more difficult to determine whether they are doing what they are supposed to do. So early on, I decided to focus in my research onto the osteoblast production part of this equation for two additional reasons. Immediately following menopause, women go into high turnover, not low turnover, and this state may persist for about a decade. And in this case, we have plenty of bone formation going on. And second of all, the first thing that changes following menopause is modulation of the collagen 1-alpha-1 expression, nothing to do with mineral. And this is work by Professor Comston. Before I mention tissue age, which is very important when we are talking about bone quality, and I would like to spend this slide to show you some data. This is a trabecular bone from a human iliac crest biopsy. One of the surfaces is undergoing formation, as we see from the tetracycline labels. Bone quality indices are not singular values in healthy bone, but actually it's a range of values. The amazing part is that 80 to 85% of that range is achieved within the double label area, after which we have a steady state for all practical purposes. And I want to show you some hard data. This is an experiment that was of interest to me, involving the study of humerus from monkey animals that were given multiple double labels, so we could follow tissue age for a period of over 2 years. And actually, the bottom page here never ceases to amaze me, because it is really a 200 by 300 area of this bone. And if we are to believe the labels, we have in this small area bone anywhere from 2 days old to over 2 years old, and not in a linear fashion either. I have no clue why. I'm sure bone does know why it behaves like that. Spectroscopically, bone mineral density, we express it as mineral to matrix, and we see that if we are to follow it over the tissue age, it has reached almost maximum value after day 21, after which it's in steady state. So we have maximum change in the minimal anatomical space. We use in the, I want to say my lab, but this is really the lab that Professor Klaus Hofer started. We use spectroscopic techniques, Raman and FTIR analysis, and they have some unique features. First of all, they treat bone as a three-component system because we can measure mineral, organic matrix, and water simultaneously. We can provide information on the mineral content, on the organic matrix content, a rather unique feature of this analysis, and water content. Also, how big the crystallites are, because we know the bigger the crystallites, the more brittle they are. Whether pyrophosphate is present in levels beyond healthy. The type of carbonate substitution in the apatite crystals, which modulates the shape and solubility of them. And as far as the organic matrix, information on glycosaminoglycans, lipids, advanced glycation products, enzymatic collagen crosslinks, tissue organization, and all this, we do it out of a single experiment. Out of a single spectrum, we can get all this information. Also, these techniques can be applied either in an imaging mode or in microspectroscopic mode, so our results can be either a function of bone turnover or independent of bone turnover. Going back to the clinic, for better or worse, the only thing available is DEXA and the bone mineral density. But reading the literature, I always find myself confused. Is BMD a surrogate or a disease? Because most papers treat it as a disease. It's a value that we need to restore, and we have cured the disease. Is this justified? These are but the latest epidemiology papers that say this is not a justified approach because there is a considerable overlap of BMD values between patients that do and do not sustain fracture. And this holds true even when BMD is implemented with algorithms such as FRAX. In one of these papers, this table exists, which, and I would like to focus on the last column, which shows the less than optimal predictive value of BMD, but also shows something very important as well. Even though the age grouping is done in five-year increments, we show a very rapid decline in the predictive value the younger the patient is. Yet fragility fractures don't occur only in the late 70s, they occur throughout life in the people that sustain them. The data I'm going to show you originated back in 2015 when Professor Klaus Hofer challenged me to show how these indices change as a function of tissue age within the same patient, but also as a function of aging, as we examine patients of older ages. So we collected iliac crest biopsies from healthy females, and we saw how they... how these parameters vary as a function of tissue age and patient age. And we also analyzed biopsies from postmenopausal osteoporotic patients. And what we did is we developed regression models for the healthy subjects, and then we saw whether the addition of the osteoporosis data changes this model or not. Our first big surprise was that as far as mineral to matrix ratio, mineral content or organic matrix content at actively bone-forming surfaces is not different. Basically, osteoporosis is healthy advanced aging. We did that for the other indices as well, and there were only two indices that would discriminate between healthy aging and osteoporosis, and they had nothing to do with bone mineral quantity or density. One had to do with how big the crystallites are that are forming, the crystallinity, and the other had to do with pyridinolin content at forming sites. And these are the actual data. Basically, osteoporotics create crystals that are much larger than healthy females, and pyridinolin content is much higher from where one would expect it based on the regression models of the healthy women. So we visited the issue of fragility fracture and realized after a couple of decades that we are very lucky because at the material level we have a single disease, fragile bone. In the clinic there is plenty of diagnosis associated with fragility, but at the material level bone is either healthy or fragile. Moreover, because it's a composite material, we expect that fragile bone would be associated with changes into any one or more of the three components. So what we did is we contacted our collaborators and collected also specimens from Hanus Hospital as they were becoming available, iliac crest biopsies that could be categorized to any of these three groups. The first is the healthy control group that I showed you before. The second is a negative control group, which is basically women with BMD values outside the healthy range, but who do not sustain fragility fractures. And the third is the fracturing group. And most of these women in the fracturing group actually had either osteopenic or perfectly healthy BMD values. Very few of them had osteoporotic BMD values. The only inclusion criteria for this study was that we have detailed densitometry data. And when we analyzed the results, we saw that at all these anatomical sites, whether we used Z-score or T-scores, basically whether we were including or excluding the children, BMD values can readily discriminate between healthy and the other two groups, but not between the negative control and the fracturing group, which gave us some confidence because this is what the epidemiology papers are saying as well. We also analyzed them by spectroscopic techniques, specifically Raman spectroscopy, and we focused on these three indices. Mineral to matrix, which has been shown to correlate with stiffness better than BMD alone, glycosaminoglycan and pyridinolin content. Glycosaminoglycans are part of proteoglycans, and proteoglycans have been shown to be negative modulator of mineral homeostasis, be inhibitors of hydroxyapatite growth and present in the canalicular network. Pyridinolin, on the other hand, has been shown to correlate with many mechanical properties of bone. And these are the results. Here, healthy are shown by the regression model and the 95% confidence interval. And we don't see a clear trend for mineral to matrix, neither for the GAGs. But we do see a grouping when it comes to pyridinolin. And other than visual, we also did ANCOVA analysis, and we see that both GAGs and pyridinolin can discriminate between the three groups. Of course, life can never be simple. And very recently, this paper appeared by Dr. Buxain. This is a retroanalysis of all the trials involving anti-osteoporosis drugs. And what they saw was that minimal gains in BMD explain a very large portion of the observed reduction in fracture. So we have a conundrum. BMD works in treated patients in predicting fracture risk, but it does not work that well in treatment-naive patients. Why is the big question? And one reason could be that in clinical trials, we always compare against placebo. Placebo is not inactive. It is a mild anti-resorptive therapy in itself. So we have to be careful what we compare our data against, and I'll show you an example. This is a clinical trial by Eli Lilly called the SOD study, where basically postmenopausal women were treated for 2 years with either zoledronate or teriparatide, and iliac crest biopsies were obtained at 6 months and 2 years. The company was interested, of course, if there is differences in bone quality formations, and there are great differences between the two drugs. But what I want to emphasize is here how the narrative can change when we compare it to different groups. If we take the data, and I'm just showing here for clarity purposes just mineral to matrix and crystallinity, but all the bone quality indices follow the same trend. If we are to compare against placebo-receiving postmenopausal osteoporotics, the results show that both therapies increase the mineral to matrix and create crystallites that are smaller compared to placebo, which is absolutely nothing new compared to various studies dealing with the individual drugs, not in a head-to-head fashion. But when we take the very same data and compare it against healthy, we see that the narrative completely changes. Now, zoledronate creates mineral-to-matrix ratios that are beyond healthy range, which is in agreement with other types of analysis, such as quantitative backscatter electron imaging and micro-CT, whereas the riparatide restores it to healthy levels. And the exact same narrative holds for the crystallinity. Zoledronate creates crystallites that are larger than healthy. The riparatide restores it to healthy levels. So I still don't know what is more useful to the clinician, but all I have to say is when we compare something, we have to be careful and be very precise of what we compare it against. So in conclusion, it is feasible to derive indices that correlate with fragility fracture much better than BMD. As a matter of fact, both glycosaminoglycans and pyridinolin seem to be very strongly correlated with fracture incidence, not fracture risk. But there is a problem here. To determine this, we need an iliac crest biopsy, something that is not done on a daily basis in the clinic. So in the future, in trying to circumvent that, what we plan to do is focus or is a two-pronged approach. One is focus on new, what I call iconoclastic techniques, such as reference point indentation. And I call them iconoclastic because, according to the literature, they associate with fragility fracture much better than BMD. It's just that nobody knows why this correlation. There is absolutely no knowledge on the mechanism. So we'll pay some attention there and see if we can come up with mechanisms why the outcomes of this technique correlate with fracture. And the other is both glycosaminoglycans and pyridinolin are not present exclusively in bone, but they are present in other tissues as well that are even more accessible for analysis. For example, skin is full of glycosaminoglycans. So maybe we can derive indices in these tissues that would correlate with bone fragility in the end. And with that, I would like to thank you for your invitation, patience, and time. My colleagues at LBO, Ludwig Boltzmann Institute for Osteology, Professor Klaus Hofer, who made it possible for me to return to Europe from the United States, my mentors that started me on this journey, and colleagues in these organizations that supported this work, either with biopsies or financially. Thank you very much for your time.